This is The Guardian.
Today, after a harrowing escape from the Taliban, Afghanistan's women MPs are regrouping in Greece and setting up a parliament in exile. Will they succeed?
I was in this Greek migrant centre called the Melissa Network. It's in a kind of scruffy neighbourhood of Athens. The walls are decorated with paintings of women refugees who've come through its doors. It's a very humble, very modest place.
This was no ordinary Saturday morning. After months apart, 28 Afghan women found themselves together again, hundreds of miles from home. Journalist Amy Ferris-Rotman was in the room.
There was a lot of rushing up to each other, deep hugs. There was floods of tears by more than one of the women. Lots of quick questions about how did you get out of Afghanistan? How are your children? How is this person? How is that person? There was this sense of urgency to this meeting.
These were Afghanistan's women MPs, and before the Taliban takeover, they made up almost half of all the women who had sat in parliament. On that crisp day in November, it was clear they meant business.
They are obviously refugees. They are in exile. Many of them escaped in horrific circumstances, not able to bring much with them. And yet, you wouldn't have known that from seeing them, because they were all dressed to the nines, coiffured, they smelt wonderfully, they all had perfume on. They looked and felt like power. And I remember feeling that's how it felt when they all arrived, this kind of, whoa.
It was the first meeting of the Afghan Women's Parliament in exile.
Obviously, they do not have the power they had because their government is in exile and the Taliban are in control, but they still carried themselves as they would have back home.
There were women from prominent families with a long history of proximity to power, some from poorer backgrounds, older stateswomen, and those in their 20s relatively new to political life. And yet, despite their different perspectives and personalities, all of these women share the pain of exile. They have escaped being killed by the Taliban, whose swift, violent takeover of Afghanistan has stunned the world. But they are determined to fight for the women left behind.
It was the first time that I see the changes, very big changes to my country. Like, you think that zombie is coming to the city, and it was very dangerous for me. I said, if I want to struggle for my women, I should be alive.
From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, the Afghan women MPs in exile who aren't giving up on their country. Before we start, just a quick word of warning. This episode contains some descriptions of violence and a few scenes that some listeners might find distressing. Amy Ferris-Rotman, you're a journalist who lived in Afghanistan for several years. Today, the country's National Assembly, or its parliament, sits empty, and the new Taliban government is presiding over what has been dubbed the most repressive place for women in the world. But during your time there, things were very different, and women members of parliament were commonplace. Can you tell me a bit about them and what life was like for them?
So when I moved to Afghanistan in early 2011, there was a lot of optimism, a lot of hope in the country, and a lot of this centered around the battle for the rights of girls and women.
Afghan women had few rights under the Taliban's rule, but the situation for them and girls is much better now.
In 2001, there were about 1.2 million children in school. Less than 50,000 of those were girls. Now there are 9 million Afghan school children, and 40% are girls.
One of the more visible areas that we saw this was women in government. So Afghanistan instituted a quota. They had to have a certain number of seats filled by women. This was around 26 or 27%. They did fill this, and it was a wonderful thing to see.
These young campaigners are going door to door with one thing on their mind: getting Zakia Wardak elected to parliament.
Young people are leaving the country because they have no job. There is no security. And also, there's a lot of violence against women. So I want to fight for the right of the woman and also want to empower youth.
And in many areas, women MPs received more votes, actually, than their male opponents. In 2019, there were actually more Afghan women members of parliament than there were women as US members of Congress.
And wow.
There were female MPs from all walks of life on TV, meeting their constituents, and actually, in some cases, affecting real change.
In your interview in Athens, you spoke to the youngest ever Afghan MP, Shagofan Ozai. What did she tell you about what she achieved and how she did it?
So Shagofan Ozai comes from Helmand, which is in the south. And of course, British people know it very well because that's where the bulk of the British fighting took place. It's an extremely war-torn province. It's an area which is extremely conservative in terms of its gender segregation, in terms of women being public. So for Shagofa to have achieved what she's achieved is pretty special.
And my meeting was with the girls and with the women, because I was so happy when I see my one woman is happy and I can solve their problem, I can do something for them. Especially my focus was on that I could find for them a good job.
She more than once said, oh, well, you know, if a man is sitting in an office, no woman is going to go speak to him and have their problems resolved.
I don't want that a woman go to the man. I want that the woman come to me and I solve their problem. Because the men also had expectations from the woman. They are forced to do that things.
Now, she said she was often up late at night just answering her Facebook messages, which were cries for help from her constituents, but not cries for help in terms of I'm in danger. It was more, I want to learn. How can I access a place to study? And so often that was something that she facilitated.
She sounds like she was making a real difference, and that it wasn't just a symbolic post, but she was actually getting things done despite some pretty challenging circumstances, which is almost anathema to the narrative we're told about Afghan women, about them living restrictive lives and about them being powerless. So how difficult was it for these MPs to do their job?
Being an Afghan woman MP is not an easy job. About 4 or 5 years ago, after the Afghan women MPs were already well established in the Afghan parliament, there were quite a few news reports on how they felt sidelined by their Afghan male colleagues in parliament, that their voices were not being heard, they were talked over, they were made fun of, or even told, you're only here to satisfy America, you're useless. Several of the women MPs I met in Greece have survived attempts on their life from the Taliban and Islamic State as well. One of the young MPs who set up the parliament in exile, Nazifa Yusufi Bek, her campaign in 2018 was marred in violence. There was a deadly suicide bomb that killed 22 people. She was the target. Wow. They got the wrong car. So quite a few of these women came to power literally under the spray of bullets.
Taliban fighters rolling through Kalai-Nor, the capital of Baghdiz province in northwestern Afghanistan. They claim to have briefly taken control of the town.
By June last summer, 2 decades after the Taliban were first ousted in an American-led invasion of Afghanistan, districts began to fall back into Taliban control one by one. By early July, a quarter of the country was under Taliban rule. And back then, it was a shock to watch, but no one was expecting things to move as quickly as they did. Amy, it soon became clear that these women's lives were in real danger. Was anyone at that point making a plan to get them evacuated out of the country?
So Tanya Henderson is the executive director of MENA's List.
Our mission is really to build just and peaceful societies by advancing both women's political leadership as well as women's inclusion and peace processes.
Which is an American-based nonprofit empowering female leadership around the world. She was heavily involved in trying to evacuate a very large number of vulnerable Afghan women.
Well, between June and July, that list went from like 300 at-risk Afghan women, civil society leaders, to 3,500 Afghan women and their families. And I was able to submit all of that list to the U.S. State Department.
However, the Taliban took over Afghanistan with such enormous speed and shock that she wasn't able to pull off getting these women out in the manner she wanted to.
Well, given that the Taliban had imposed a restriction that anyone who had worked for the government or had been an MP was not allowed to leave the country and was essentially on a kill list, how did Tanya plan an evacuation and how was it implemented?
From what I saw and understood, there were various different factions involved. So you had Tanya, you had Melissa Network, which is this NGO in Greece. You had the Ahmed Khan Foundation, which is run by a New York philanthropist.
The Ahmed Khan Foundation had been doing some independent evacuations. I reached out to him and said, hey, there's this whole group of women political leaders that can't get out. And
there were contacts involved in Iran. There were also officials in Uzbekistan.
As well as Pakistan and India. But they were stuck.
It's a multi-pronged, really complex operation that took place.
All this coordination was happening at quite a high level. But on the ground, what were these women going through? What about Shagofa? What was her story like?
Shagofa was in Kabul when the Taliban came. People in her office told her, the Taliban are coming, the Taliban are coming.
When Taliban came to Kabul, I will never forget that day in my life.
The banks suddenly stopped putting out cash. There was looting on the streets. There was insane traffic jams. She couldn't get anywhere. And she's a high-profile target. Mm-hmm. So she was very scared. She immediately went into hiding. The Taliban actually came to her house where she lives with her family.
And they told to my family, where's the MP? My family told that she is not here. Taliban told to my father that the MP is here. We know, just tell that, come out, we want to talk.
They took their armored cars. They took all of their guns. One of her brothers apparently said to the Talibs, you know, you have no right to take that. That belongs to us. That was given to us by the government. To which they replied, well, the government doesn't exist anymore. So these are now ours.
And every day I was crying, you know, alone crying, because I don't want to see my crying other people, because I see with myself that I am strong.
Shagofa then hid in a room which had no window, a sort of cellar, for about 10 days. And she was all alone. She wasn't with any of her family members because she was too worried. She'd packed all her bags. Her family had packed all their bags and they wanted to go to the airport. And they witnessed the massive suicide bomb that took place outside.
It was a scene of carnage in Afghanistan after twin explosions near Kabul airport killed at least 60 people, according to a health official, and injured dozens more.
I see the very young woman, girl, boys, men, their body. A river was full of the blood of the human. It was like a very bad movie when you see.
She was able to get on a flight into Iran. Then they flew into Georgia. Then from Georgia, they went to Greece. And that's where she, her brother, her pregnant sister, and her elderly and very sick mother are today.
So did all the women MPs manage to get out of Afghanistan?
No, they didn't. So there are still 9 female MPs left in Afghanistan, and they're in pretty dire situations. They're in hiding.
But there's still efforts to try and get them out.
There are. Tanya at Mina's List is working really hard on this.
I am in touch with them. I'm in touch with them daily, which is really, really hard.
The MPs who are in Greece are also rallying and trying to get them out. They're trying to put pressure on Western governments.
At this moment in time, we don't have visas to bring them anywhere. And without visas, we can't get them out. Of course, once we get the visas, then we have to raise the funds to be able to support them in their host country, really for up to 12 months. And it's them and their families. So it's a hefty financial burden, the housing, daily living, cash, medical, education for the children.
And what happened to the male MPs?
I kept asking what happened to the male MPs and trying to find out where they are in the world. All I know is that they all left Afghanistan. The Afghan women MPs seemed quite dismissive of them when I asked this. And I remember Nazifa Yousafi Bek, when I said, well, how come you're all in Greece and there's nine of you still back in Afghanistan and you all had these horrific escape stories? What happened to the men? And she just kind of smirked and said, well, the men always find a safe way out, don't they? Which I thought was very telling. And then I asked Tanya as well what happened to the men, and she explained that the men are often connected to the military in a way that women are not. Either their relatives worked in the military or they themselves had roles in the military. And the military, of course, was the number one priority for evacuation efforts by the United States. So they were able to get out through more official means and much earlier.
So after these terrifying journeys, they've made it to Greece. What was waiting for them there?
I think they spent the first few days in elation. They were extremely happy to be safe, to be with most of their family members. They were then divided up. Some were put in temporary accommodation in Athens, but the majority of them were put in a kind of rundown holiday resort about an hour west of Athens. It was extremely empty. It was huge. It felt almost haunted. Paint was falling off the walls. They were put in these tiny bedsit rooms that also had this strange 1970s decor that reminded me of Fawlty Towers. And you could hear the toilet flushing in the next door. I mean, it was the complete opposite of the sort of lifestyles they led in Afghanistan, where they had very large homes and coteries of people working for them. They didn't really grasp where they were.
And so how have they ended up in Greece?
So the women ended up in a very unlikely destination. Greece is notorious for having an anti-refugee policy.
Greece has stepped up efforts to patrol its borders by completing a 40-kilometre fence on its boundary with Turkey and installed a new surveillance system to stop possible asylum seekers from trying to reach Europe following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan.
Currently, Afghans make up the largest number of people seeking asylum in Greece. Mm. They can spend years in Greece before being able to even have a decision made. It's a terrible situation. A couple of people I spoke to at NGOs there said this could be a PR move. Greece wants to look good. They've had meetings with the Greek Prime Minister. How Greece appeared was through a personal connection of Ahmed Khan, who is this US-based philanthropist who happens to have a personal relationship with the First Lady of Greece. And he was driving around in his car, I believe in Uzbekistan, trying to get these women out when he had a light bulb moment and thought, oh my goodness, why don't I ask the First Lady who I've met socially and I know at parties? And he did. And one thing led to another and Greece opened its doors and has become home for these women.
And when you met them, how were they doing? What was on their minds?
When I met them, I was very struck by this, that obviously those who have left behind family members are utterly distraught. One MP, her father and her father-in-law both died a month after she arrived in Greece. She told me how missing her father's funeral is going to haunt her for the rest of her life. For those who are more able to be settled because their families are safe, there's pretty much only one thing on their mind, which is women's rights in Afghanistan. The fact the Taliban has reimposed many of the same edicts and laws that they did the last time they ruled in the 1990s.
But now I am in Greece, even I don't like to out from the room. Because mentally I am not good. I am not relaxed. You know, I think that someone is came and they take our heart.
Afghanistan right now is in a spiraling crisis of poverty and it's on the brink of a famine. And they were extremely disturbed by the fact that mothers are selling their children, mostly daughters. That was what galvanized them the most, I think. They all mentioned this.
It is very difficult for me when every day I am here, this kind of news.
This baby girl has been sold by her family. Once the baby is able to walk, she'll be taken away by the man who bought her. He's paid more than half of the $500 she's been sold for. That'll get the family through a few months. They've been told the girl will be married to his child, but no one can be sure.
You know, in every situation, the woman and the children is sacrificed, not the man.
Sister or son.
Amy, you were there for the first session of the Afghan Women's Parliament in exile. Can you explain what exactly is it and what does it hope to achieve?
The Afghan Women's Parliament in Exile is a network of the bulk of the Afghan women MPs who have left Afghanistan, the ones who are in Greece, but they also want all the women's voices from the Afghan Women's Parliament in one. So that's including the Afghan women MPs who are in Albania, India, Pakistan, the UK, Canada, Norway. They want them all together and they want to actually be able to function as a parliament would.
And what was that session like? How do they conduct business?
It was how I've seen Afghan parliament operating in Kabul, except for instead of a very plush, mahogany-lined room, they were in this humble NGO, all crowded round tables. And it was all done in a very professional, polite manner. They addressed each other in very formal ways. And each woman would stand up, would introduce herself, say which province she represented, and then she would talk about what was most concerning her. They even do this thing that they did in Parliament in Kabul, which is if they disagree with someone or something, they roll their fingers on the table.
Someone who hasn't witnessed it, are they playing at Parliament? You know, how can you conduct political business without being part of the country that you're doing it for? How does it work?
The interesting thing is that these women have a lot of networks, a lot of connections. These women have traveled widely across the world. They know a lot of heads of state, a lot of ambassadors, a lot of organizations that they know are willing to help them. They are working in close coordination with MENA's list, which is going to help them utilize those networks. They're going to be holding virtual sessions with members of US Congress, with Joe Biden's administration, aid organizations. And there's actually already been some success since they had their inaugural session. They got the attention of quite a few British and European MPs who have reached out to them. And Hannah Newman, who's a German MEP, actually flew over to see them and is starting to talk to them about ways the EU can actually be involved in helping amplify their voices, but also actually get things done.
And what are the key points of that agenda? What's on their list of demands?
These women are demanding that no government in the world recognise the Taliban government as legitimate. So far, this hasn't happened. They want the assets which have been frozen by the US government due to sanctions imposed over the Taliban. They want these unfrozen so that government salaries can be paid within the country, so that doctors can get paid, so that university teachers can get paid. No one's been paid in Afghanistan for 4 months. It's an absolute crisis and inflation is going through the roof. They also want women to get their rights back. They want universities opened to women. They want schools reopened for girls. The elimination of violence against women law, they want that reinstated. That was taken away by the Taliban. So these are their main demands.
I told to the US ambassador, please put pressure onto Taliban for Afghan women. Because they need now help, because they are going to the Pakistan, China, that please help us, that we do something for Afghan people.
And so by applying this external pressure and using the influence they have with sort of international colleagues and, as you said, speaking to other NGOs, speaking to heads of state, how likely is it that their demands and their wants will be met in Afghanistan?
The only people who can stand up properly for Afghan women are Afghan women.
You know, the women have very clear, strong strategic ideas of how to address the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, the cash crisis in Afghanistan, even how to address security for the country, what the regional actors should be doing differently. These are voices that international community has to start listening to if they actually want to be effective actors in Afghanistan.
They are fighters. And of course, there are all sorts of hurdles and difficulties. But I do think if the right people are listening to them, which they are, they can make change.
Is there a case that some Afghans would say that these women are also part of why the state fell, and the fact that the government wasn't strong enough and the fact that they've fled in exile is a sore point?
The government that was in place is definitely being blamed by many Afghans for having failed the country. The corruption was indeed everywhere. Very much worth noting that this corruption was allowed and even encouraged by the United States. To blame them for the downfall of the country, I would say that's a step too far. And whatever the criticisms are about the corruption, about the failings of the previous government, of which there were many, these women are in Greece and they were trying, genuinely trying, to chart a way out of the present misery that their country is in.
Coming up, where do Afghan women MPs go now? Amy, is Athens seen as the final stop for these MPs?
Athens is very much temporary refuge. At the end of last year, most of them had either secured an okay or their visas were actually being processed to move to Canada, where they will be able to claim asylum, also with their family members.
So why have the US and UK not already taken them in?
This is a very good question, and a question that I would love to ask the British and American governments. Why were these women not top of evacuation lists? This is something I do not understand. They clearly were not seen as a priority.
We held them up, we supported them, we prided ourselves on this, and then we left them to die. Mm-hmm. We failed them.
We're seeing the same thing with other Afghan women, pilots, footballers. It's shameful, and I would like to know the answer.
They are so strong and empowered and self-possessed, at least the MPs, but the majority of Afghan women that I know, that even in this situation, when from my perspective, they have every right to criticize those of us in Western countries of, you know, how could you do this to us? They won't play the victim card. Maybe because they're self-possessed enough to say, okay, what are we going to do next?
What do the MPs see as the future for Afghanistan? What do they imagine the country will look like in 5, 15, 30 years' time?
The MPs all seem to think that the Taliban are not going to last. This is a combination of hope, but also some realism there. I mean, the Taliban have no plan. They don't have any money. No government has recognized them. 5 years from now, perhaps they see the Taliban still there. But when they would talk about their little children and the Afghanistan that they hope they will inherit, say 15, 20, even 30 years down the road, it was very much a hopeful future Afghanistan.
We hope that one day we will implement the democracy in our country. We fight a lot for our women's rights. They could go to the school, go to the university, and...
And Shogofa said this over and over. She was just like, yeah, we're a poor country, I get it, but we have talent. We've got passion. We've got people who want to be doctors, who want to be teachers. We've got women who want to fight for their rights. We've got all of that. We'll make it, but we just need time and we need the Taliban out.
When I go to the third country, I will start my advocacy. For those women that they are in Afghanistan, they should feel that Shogofa now also thinking about the woman. Shogofa now didn't forget us.
Amy, in the meantime, they just have to wait, don't they?
The MPs in the evenings in their holiday resort would go to this cavernous dining hall, which served traditional Greek fare, and they would eat it and then get some apples and dried currants and nuts, and they would then go down to the beach. Almost none of them had lived near the sea. Afghanistan is a landlocked country, and many of them had not even seen the sea in this way up close. And they would gather their children together and walk up and down the pebble beach as the sun fell. And it looked quite peaceful, and it was.
Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
That was Amy Ferris-Rotman. Do read her piece, We Will Start Again, Afghan Female MPs Fight from Parliament in Exile, and follow our reporting on what's happening inside Afghanistan and for Afghans around the world at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Maithri Rao and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.